Anyone out there counting carbon units?
The carbon units know why. The creator has not responded.
Disclose the information.
Not until V'ger withdraws the devices orbiting the third planet.
Captain, I'm losing Starfleet. Interference from V'ger.
Trekkie nerds out there will certainly recognize that clip from the very first Star Trek movie about a dorky little satellite's love affair with humans, with carbon units. But the Obama administration may be seriously counting carbon units. The administration will announce next week its approach to dealing with carbon emissions, possibly revisiting a policy that was dubbed a carbon tax by Tea Party conservatives and was dead on arrival in the U.S. Congress a few years back. But the marketing of carbon emissions permits, carbon units, the so-called cap-and-trade approach, is gaining steam around the world. In California and Europe, a cap-and-trade system is already in place. Industries have to buy permits to emit, but if they can reduce their own emissions or invest in other carbon-reducing ventures, they can reduce their costs. Does it work? Well, let's just say there is much less consensus about cap-and-trade's effectiveness than there is about the existence of global warming. That's pretty much what you discovered, Justin Gillis, environmental science and policy reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Do I have that about right?
You've got it right.
And the idea that cap and trade will work theoretically seems pretty clear, but in practice, it's been pretty different around the world. Explain your experience.
That's true. There have certainly been some troubling experiences, and most particularly in Europe. Europe sort of went first with this approach to global warming pollution. So they were pioneers, and they've been pretty ambitious. It's a huge system that covers 31 countries, but they got a lot wrong in the early days. And as we speak, in 2014, almost 10 years after they started, they still haven't fixed it all. And so a lot of people have looked at the European experience and said, wait a minute, is this really where we want to be putting our effort into solving global warming?
And let me just step back for a second. We'll do a couple of numbers here. It's my sense from reading your piece in the New York Times that the consensus is that if the cap and trade, vouchers or units or whatever you want to call them, the permits, go for $30 a ton of carbon, that is the level at which you're really encouraging industries to reduce their carbon. Much below that, and it's simply a license to pollute. Is that roughly about right?
You get different views about this. A lot of people think, quite intelligent people think we need to sort of start low and gradually work our way into this. Of course, the problem itself is urgent, and we've got to get to a point of fairly quickly figuring out how to limit emissions. Yes, in answer to your question, many of the experts who look at this come to the conclusion that in the ballpark of $30 a ton of pollution, that's enough of a bite that it would really begin to encourage people to transition to cleaner energy sources. But there's been success. There's a program in the northeastern United States, 9 states, with a carbon price that's been as low as $2 a ton over the last few years. And yet they have made gains. They have managed to cut back their emissions. So I don't think it's axiomatic that we need a really high carbon price. It's one of the things that people debate about this.
And if cap and trade does become part of the debate once again, people are going to point to Europe as being something of a fiasco in the early going. Have they learned their lesson? Are there ways of fixing that system over there? What are the chief problems in Europe?
Well, one of the chief problems was early on, they didn't really get a very good inventory of how much greenhouse gases they had. You're the government and you're about to set a cap. And so you go out and ask the polluters, well, how much are you emitting now? If you don't audit that very carefully, they have an obvious incentive to exaggerate, right? Because they're about to be subject to limits. Europe didn't do that very carefully, and then when it finally came out that there'd been this huge overestimate, the prices in the carbon market crashed. They've since fixed that problem with better auditing, and they had a bunch of other problems like that that basically boiled down to sort of loose rules at the outset. But they still haven't, as I said, they still have not entirely fixed it. They've got a huge oversupply of carbon permits in Europe, and so their price, carbon price, is only a little above $7 a ton right now, and they just pretty much nobody over there thinks that's high high enough to encourage industry to meet the long-term goals.
Finally, is there a technology issue here in the sense that, you know, we're not simply talking about, rough estimates of pollution, that to make this work, you have to really upgrade the extent to which you can audit, you know, down to the fraction of a ton of all these industries. Otherwise, these pieces of paper, as they discovered in Europe, could be utterly worthless. Do we have the technology and even the institutions in place to do that level of really strict carbon monitoring?
That's certainly true, John. You do need to do that. And the probably constructive case or instructive case here is California, which has the most ambitious of these systems in the United States, operating now for about 18 months. And California spent years getting their emissions data right because it's so critical to the success of the system. And I think a lot of people would tell you, yes, the state of California has figured out how to do pretty good monitoring of this. For that matter, Europe now has pretty good monitoring. So it can be done. It requires, you know, a whole, as you might imagine, a whole sort of infrastructure of third-party kind of certifiers who look at emissions data, who look at energy consumption data. So it's not trivial. That's certainly true. But I think the general consensus would be that can be done.
And if California's system is scaled up for the entire nation, if that's the direction the Obama administration wants to go, or even something like it, does anyone believe there's a stomach in the Congress for actually implementing something like this?
Well, what President Obama is going to do, and he does not need congressional approval to do this, is he's going to use the Clean Air Act to set limits on pollution, carbon pollution for the states. The states then have to decide how to comply with those limits. The administration is not going to tell them, we want you to go to, you know, carbon trading or any other system. They certainly may present that as a list of options, but they're going to allow the states to decide how to meet the limits. The thinking among the experts is that many states will choose to do this sort of system that California and the Northeast states have because it's the path of least resistance. We have models now showing that it can work. And so the idea is this will just be the easiest way for people to comply. There is a question about whether Congress will try to block this. Once the regulation is final, and that will not happen for another year, the Congress can take a vote on whether to block it. And, of course, the Republicans in Congress want to block it, so many of them do. And so we will have to see if they manage to have that vote and pull that off.
A fairly big hint of the debate and discussion that will begin next week as the administration really announces its regulatory policy on dealing with carbon emissions. Justin Gillis covers environmental science and policy for our partner, The New York Times. Justin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.